have their sorrow, the wretched have their rage. Pray for the aged, it's the dawn of another age, of another age, of another age, of another age, of another age.
Welcome to Radio Free Canada. I'm Kevin Annett, back live after several weeks of hiatus, when I was involved in several important off-the-radar projects, which some of which we'll get into today and others we'll save for later. But we are back live here on Radio Free Canada every Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific. That is Phil Oakes, my man. He was singing Another Age, another great folk singer from the 60s who died suddenly and mysteriously. But we're still kicking, I'm still here, you're still here, and that's what counts. Today we are going to do a couple of things. We're going to talk about an amazing series of events that are going to be happening in April this year, including the taking down of a number of planned rituals by the infamous Ninth Circle sacrificial cults. There's a notice about that up at itccs.org today for you folks if you want to catch up on that. We're going to talk about that first and then bring on our special guest, who is a clergywoman who is not going by her real name for reasons which we will explain and it'll be evident. She was forced out of her church very recently in the last few years because she dared to report child abuse going on in her congregation. And the manner in which they got rid of her is so familiar to me and others who've gone up against this thing called the church. And we're going to talk with her about the details of her story, but also the broader implications. How do we stop these criminal organizations masking as churches? If you have comments, if you want to have input, write republicofcanada@gmail.com. And we appreciate the fact that our listenership is continually increasing. Thank you all. And one of the things I want to, well, let me jump into the first news report here, but I do want to talk about a new front opening up in our work, and it's very important. So the news release that came out yesterday involved the fact that on April 30th, which is Beltane, or also called Valpurgis Night, it's a high point in the satanic calendar where children are routinely killed on that time of year. We have learned, and by we, I mean the ITCCS Central Office, that the International Tribunal of Crimes of Church and State, for you folks who may be new, we've been around since 2010, and we've successfully prosecuted and brought down the Black Pope and the White Pope. And Murder by Decree has some of the evidence that we base this on, the crimes of genocide in Canada. But the ITCCS Central Office has come by information from insiders in government and church in Europe that the Ninth Circle is holding a very large, extensive series of rituals on April 30th, Beltane, the end of this month. They're going to be in nine cities, and basically the children are going to be tortured and ritually killed at those events. Now, these cities include Rome, Montreal, Washington, D.C., London, Paris, Brussels, Geneva, Frankfurt, and Tara, Ireland. It's interesting, Ireland, because that news has just come out about the graves discovered, the mass graves of dismembered babies' corpses at a Catholic facility not too far from there in Goat County, Galway. Now, in response, the common law court that brought in the verdict against Bergoglio, Ratzinger, and others, the so-called popes in Rome, in response to this new threat from the Ninth Circle, they have reissued what came out on April 20th, 2014, which was a papal nullification order. Essentially, what the common law court said was because it's a convicted criminal body that's convicted under international law and common law of crimes against humanity, child trafficking, and other bestial crimes, the Catholic Church does not have the right to operate. It's what's called a transnational criminal organization in the United Nations parlance. International law says that if you traffic human beings, you launder money, you do criminal activities, all of which the Vatican does, they don't have the right to operate, and citizens and police have the right to go in there and arrest their officials. Well, that's exactly what they're going to do. They're dispatching special teams, just like they did August 15th, 2014, where we actually stopped a non-circle ritual in Outremont, in the suburbs of Montreal. They're going to do it again, only on a bigger scale. And it's you can see the news release at itccs.org. One of the sources said this is one of the biggest gatherings of the Ninth Circle in years, We've been told that top political, business, and church figures will be participating, including from Russia and China, areas not normally associated with a circle. Something very big is afoot. So in response to that, you'll also notice on our posting, there's a call that's gone out basically urging people to take direct action. We are going to be announcing the location of where these Ninth Circle killings are happening. And as we've done in other countries, we're going to encourage people that to come out to these churches and help stop these events. We've shown them in the past, if you confront these churches beforehand, sometimes it's they're stopped. And so we can literally save lives by mobilizing people with that knowledge. So stay tuned, especially next week. We'll have some of these locations for you. The other thing to remember is that the verdict brought in by the Common Law Court places all of us under a new jurisdiction outside corporate Vatican canon law, under which a lot of governments were established. We now stand under common law, so we can take action against these criminals in high places. That's the important point. Another front that's opening up, and we got contacted, the office in Brussels and others, got contacted by a group in Serbia. Now, a little-known genocide, it's very amazingly similar to the genocide in Canada. It's hidden, and it was aimed at the children. It was the Croatian genocide of Serbs, Jews, and Gypsies in the 1930s, funded and organized directly out of the Vatican. Now, this was Pope Pius XI ordered that the Serbs, who were Orthodox Christians, not Catholics, were to be wiped out. And here's a little-known fact. You never heard of a place called Janasevic. Janasevic was a concentration camp run by the Catholic Church. The commandant was a bishop in the Croatian Catholic Church, Simovic. And they herded 1.5 million people into this place. They had after Treblinka and Auschwitz, it was the third biggest killing operation in Europe. Have you ever heard of it? No, the reason you haven't is because the Croatian genocide was wiped out of the memory of Europeans after the war, because a lot of these Croatian Nazis, they were called the Ustashi, helped bring the other Nazis out through the Vatican-run rat lines to North America and South America, the rat lines that snuck the Nazis out of Europe after the war with the help of the CIA and others. And, of course, since the Vatican had directly organized and run this genocide, that, of course, would embarrass the post-war situation, since the Americans needed the Vatican, for one thing, to keep the Italian communists out of power in Italy during the 1947 elections. And so all of this is more proof of the fact that a genocide run by the Catholic Church directly, as in Canada, the crimes are happening at the hands of Catholic clergy. So there's a group in Serbia that is conducting, and they asked for our help in setting up a common law court to prosecute this genocide, to bring charges against the Vatican, who are completely denying, as they do in Canada, any responsibility for the death of over a million people at their own hands. And they're convening in Belgrade in the fall. They're going to convene this common law court with our help. One of the charges they're bringing is against NATO, of course, for the bombing of Belgrade that killed over 3,000 people in 1995. And so anyway, that's another front opening up, and it's directly relevant to what we're going to be talking about today. And, of course, the final thing, I noticed that our guest is on the line. I'll go to her just in a minute. But don't forget, April 15th is the 12th anniversary of the launching in Canada of Aboriginal Holocaust Memorial Day that really brought to light and forced the Canadian government to acknowledge some of these crimes of genocide. So we're going to be acknowledging that next week, of course, and remembering the brave brothers and sisters who died in that struggle to bring out the truth of the genocide. So, without further ado, let's go to our guest. Hello, are you there?
I'm very honored and excited to be here with you today and to share my tiny little story to add credence to all the work that you and your organization have been doing over the years.
Well, thank you. And let me say, I know that you wanted to go by the name Lillian, if that's all right.
Yes.
And that's what I'll call you, if that works.
Yes. And, Lillian is the name of my great-grandmother, mm-hmm. and she is 100% Cherokee, and it is through her that I belong to my nation. And for me, many of the things that I do with particularly as it pertains to Indigenous First Nations people has to do with the lifting up the honor and the memory of her, as she was the child of the sole survivor in my family who survived the Trail of Tears.
So. Okay, well, that's good to know. And I want to thank you for coming on. Now, what I'll tell the listeners is that you are a clergywoman, an American. That's all we're going to say.
Yes.
And I do want you to share in your own words basically what happened to you.
Yes, I appreciate that. And thank you for protecting my anonymity, as I think so many of us see what happened to you and other whistleblowers, and when given the opportunity to protect anonymity, it gives us a chance to continue to work in the trenches, to do this work, to help save lives, as you said, but it prevents us from having to go through some of the horrible repercussions that happen to whistleblowers, and I'm so sorry about the things that you've experienced.
Well, thank you. But go ahead.
What happened to
get the floor.
In my case was I have been an ordained minister for 10 years. This particular incident happened at about 7-year mark, so I had experience in the ministry. I also am somebody who, in my education, I've studied the ethics and the laws. So I'm particularly somebody who is aware, wherever you are in the United States, how to make sure that you're in compliance with the laws of that state, as well as what are your ethical requirements, in my case as a Christian, but within whatever your religious belief is.
Mm-hmm.
So in the situation that occurred, I had been made aware of a possible sexual abuse against a child that could have been occurring over a span of 10 years. At that point, I'm required by state law to work with a lawyer and determine at what point am I a mandated reporter. And it wasn't long after the first initial incident that I was made aware of happened that I was given direct information that this abuse was occurring. Therefore, at that point, I had to report. In my particular denomination as a Protestant minister, I was required to report any reporting I would be doing to civil authorities to the administrators in my church, first and foremost, to keep them aware. And that's something you need to keep in mind, because we'll come back to that. I did that. I reported it to my administrator, and they encouraged me to report to the civil authorities and said that this was the correct thing to do. I made that report, and the child was removed from the home. Then at that point, since it was a weekend, there wasn't a lot of communication that I was involved in. However, I did have a communication with this administrator, the church administrator, the next day on Saturday, and she again affirmed that this was the right thing to have done, and she said, quote, "I'm proud of you." Then, as far as I knew, I didn't know of any other communication that was occurring. And then finally, on Monday, I was requested to go to that administrator's office to bring my spouse with me, who is not an ordained minister. And it was at that meeting that the rug was pulled out from underneath me. And I was informed that I was going to be forced to resign. And I was asked to sign a letter, which to this day I didn't read. I wish I had read, but human emotions intervene,
yep.
And at the time I didn't have the means and the ability.
Now, this person who made you sign the letter, was this the same administrator who had encouraged you two
yes.
days before?
And that's the thing. This is the exact same administrator who had said, quote, "I am proud of you," and then mm-hmm. on Monday said to me that I was going to need to resign and sign this letter. And over the next 20 minutes...
Did she give a reason?
Her reason was that I was not... She gave several reasons. One of them was that I was not required by our denomination to have reported. and so that I shouldn't have done that, which doesn't make sense to me. That never makes sense to me. The second reason was that I was going to be damaging the congregation, that it was more damaging to the congregation to have this child protected from 10 years of egregious sexual abuse by a family member, and also instigated by the person who had legal authority over the child, that it was right. I needed to protect the congregation, and that three, I had damaged my relationship with the powers of the congregation by reaching out to civil authorities and not handling this quote-unquote in-house.
Well, what was your first, I mean, let me ask you what your take is on this. Why would this administrator do a flip-flop in 2 days like that and I go after you and get rid of you?
Yeah, well, I think it's because from the very moment that I became the pastor of that congregation, which was a congregation specifically made up of indigenous peoples and for indigenous peoples, mm-hmm. that the very minute I became the pastor of that congregation 2.5 years prior, she saw me as somebody who was a threat to her power, because the mandate of this congregation was to lift up the needs of the indigenous peoples and to place them in positions of power. And
uh-oh.
I was somebody who believed in that. Yeah, exactly, right? And so then she said to me within 2 weeks of my showing up first day for work, as the called minister of this church, that, quote, my congregation was nothing but children and drunks. And that
she told you that before you started.
She said that to me, and that she was going to, quote, shutter the doors. So, in essence, from the very beginning, I was standing in the way of that. Because as far as I can tell, the very mandate of the church, which is to empower the indigenous peoples to positions of power, is the very thing that the church cannot have. And that, by the church, I mean capital letter C, and that can mean Roman Catholic, that can mean any number of Protestant. It doesn't matter. At that point, that it stands up against their authority, which is not, you know, for the good, right?
Right. And, of course, their own history of genocide.
And their own history of genocide, and that history of genocide as being perpetuated in the past and then currently still continuing, and what we are fighting with all of our powers and strengths to stop for the future.
Right. Well, it's interesting, Lillian, because when I got canned by the United Church for doing something very similar to you, giving a platform for Native people on the west coast of Canada, the day they fired me, they asked me to bring my wife down to the church with me, and they gave it to us hammers and tongs that day. I saw it designed to try to break us, to create a division within, which happened.
I'm really grateful that my husband did not fall for that, because it was true. She would go back and forth between me and my husband, and I think what's interesting for us as a family is that he had always been a Christian and an active layperson, but he had never been one to be called to the ministry. And so in essence, he saw what I did, you know, as my job. And it was my job, and he participated in it. Just he has his job. Well, he was so shocked when he was called down there for that meeting, you know, to the point where he was kind of ticked off. Why do I have to go to this meeting? But it was in that room that it backfired on them. I would agree with you. They were attempting to tear us apart. But really what happened is my husband knew the measures that needed to be done to protect me so that
right.
I could fight the future fight. So at that point, I was, because I wouldn't sign the letter, what happened next was she put in front of me a post-it note. And she just kept saying, just quit. She became very, using that method of communication where you just say the same thing over again. It's called a broken record. So she kept saying, just quit. And then she would turn to my husband and she would say, get her to quit, just quit.
Amazing.
And I was resisting, because in my mind, I was the the pastor of that congregation, and I still had a commitment to them that I was to help shepherd and protect them so that they could have that mandate. Finally, I looked at my husband, and he said, just say I quit. Just say I quit. And so I have this post-it note where I wrote, I quit. That's all I wrote. She took the post-it note from me, wrote my name, and wrote the date on it.
Whoa, she's in a hurry, eh? There's an emergency here.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then we then left that office, went back to our office, or our home, I'm sorry. I immediately called my lawyer, and he was quite shocked to find out that this had happened because, in his mind, the previous Friday, we had done a good thing. We had helped get a child protected from abuse. And he immediately drafted a letter for me to go get this post-it note back.
Right.
And he emailed it to me, and he emailed it to her office, and he said, print this off, go back, hand it to her, I'll show up, and we'll get the letter. I went over to the office again, this time without my husband. I handed her the letter, and I said, I believe you have this as well already in your email box. And she, and 30 minutes had passed from the moment I had left her office, gone home, and come back. And she said to me, it's too late. I've already FedExed it to the head church.
Let me ask you something, Lillian.
Yeah.
Why do you think, it sounds like she just set you up when she encouraged you one day and then turned around and knocked you in the back
of the neck. Absolutely. God bless me for having the heart of a pastor, but at the same time, it sets me up to not always be on the ball. And I really regret that I fell for that trap, that she was setting me up.
Why was she setting you up? For the reasons you said earlier, she wanted you out of that congregation.
Yes, this was her opportunity to get me out of that congregation. And what actually occurred on Saturday that I found out later was that she was in direct communication with the woman who was the legal authority over the child who had been abused. She colluded with the woman who had the legal authority over the child, who was allowing this abuse to happen to a child for 10 years from the age of 6 to 16. She directly went to her to back her up.
Sounds like the Catholic Church.
Yeah, and then they, I don't think I shared this part of the story with you. They wrote up a series of false letters from the woman who had the authority over the child.
Right.
And I'm sorry I have to say that in such unusual language, but I'm trying to protect anonymity. They had her write up a series of letters against me.
Oh, boy.
Yep. On pastoral, what they called pastoral overreach. And there were absolute lies in there. And that's the second thing to understand about this administrator. The first thing is, from the very minute I got there, she wanted to let me know that she was going to get rid of me. And number two, she consistently lied. And that was hilarious at times, because she would lie to my face about a previous thing she had said to me, and there would never be a witness either time. She was never willing to state the truth.
Now, this happened in the last few years, didn't it? This isn't like 20 years ago.
No, this happened 3 years ago, and actually a beautiful thing has come of it, and that is that the child really did get taken away from the family and was placed in the state care, and because of her age, it's unusual that a child that age would be placed in state care, because with the lack of resources, they have a tendency to say if somebody's by the age of 16, et cetera, then they can't help them. They need to help younger children. She reached out to me this last fall, so at the age of 19, to inform me that she didn't know I had lost my job because of this incident, and that I was the only person in her life that had ever listened to her, and had ever acted in a way, in follow-through, that didn't allow her family to intimidate me, that got her safe, and that she was so sad when she found out I had lost my job. And I said to her, I'd do it all over again.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Exactly. Yep.
But the consequence for her is she has a new life.
Excellent.
She is no longer connected to the abusive members of her family.
Good.
And she has a glimmer of hope. And let me tell you, to even have just a glimmer of hope for this person is amazing.
Well, yeah.
Because she
went through hell.
That's
really great. And, you know, she's going to carry that with her whole life. You're an inspiration and always will be for her.
Well, and what I wanted her to learn is that there are good people that will follow through.
Mm-hmm.
But what the lesson is for me is in those 10 years, she was reaching out. And do you know who she was reaching out to, Kevin? She was reaching out at times to other ministers in my denomination at that church, and nobody, because she said it to me, nobody followed through, and
no.
All of them were intimidated by her family. So what that
right.
means to me is every single person before me colluded.
Exactly.
Because they didn't
the
protect the child. They went with the, quote-unquote, protect the congregation, whatever
right.
that means, right?
Well, it means protect the abuser. It means
it does. It means protect the abuser, and more importantly, it means protect the system that abuses.
Exactly. Well, that leads us into another aspect of this, is that the smear campaign and attacks that followed. Do you want to talk briefly about that?
Yeah. It happened right away. I lost almost all colleagues. They either would not talk to me, or initially when they did talk to me, particularly all of the other pastors in my area who served indigenous congregations, they said to me I was wrong to have reported it and
right.
that I should have protected the congregation. So,
wow.
In other words, they completely affirmed what the child had said. And furthermore, I was even told by one of the pastors who's worked close to 30 years as a minister in an indigenous community, that it was the absolute wrong thing to do, and that I needed to learn to live with the native ways, and that this this was something that went against native ways. And then...
Oh, yeah, natives abuse her. Well, I mean,
yeah.
It's so ludicrous. It's like... That mentality, I want to talk to you a bit later about this. What is it about that corporate mentality that says the existence of our little group is more important than the life of a child?
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
You get that at
absolutely.
Every level of these churches.
When that goes against, in my case, as a Christian, a biblical Christian, it goes against what was taught to me by Jesus, by Christ, and by... you know, other later biblical writers. It goes against the foundations of my faith. I mean,
mm-hmm.
just to say it, Jesus left the flock to search for the one.
Well,
that
you know, that's the trouble when you
do.
When you start acting out what Jesus says.
Well, and what happened to Jesus, right?
Eventually.
What happened to Jesus? He died.
Well.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
The other thing about that is that I will say the one pastor who didn't leave my side, or two, there were two. There was one pastor who pastored in an indigenous church, and then there was a pastor in the town I lived in. And there was one pastor who didn't leave my side, and that was the one who pastored an indigenous church and also was in that area of the country, the only indigenous pastor himself. How interesting is that? The person
yep.
who's in the system that abuses children, I'm saying this in quotes, he's the one person who has been able to live out that mandate to be an indigenous pastor with some authority in the church, and he stood by me. And so that
right.
that shows to me that as far as the population of who I was serving, that they knew I was doing the right thing, and they knew my heart was in the right place.
Exactly.
And then the other person who's stood by me was somebody that the church had deemed as quote-unquote conservative. And I always think that's interesting how we, by putting labels on people,
mm-hmm.
we're able to then control them, or at least the church thinks it can.
Oh, yeah.
And so she was an isolated person who didn't have a lot of support. But she's a wonderful minister because she knows what it's like to pastor without a lot of support. So I had the right people in my corner. I did have a pastor who I had known for 14 years.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I've known him for 14 years now. So at the time, I'd known him for 11 years. I'd done a lot of ministry with him, and I called him up to reach out to him because I was so surprised by all the attacks that were coming against me. And he said to me, well, I didn't know you were a liar, and now I do.
Right. Well, and you can just imagine things being said about you. So let me just ask you again. She got rid of you to basically cover up abuse and all the stuff that you were trying to do, shut it down. They smeared you, and they made it impossible, obviously, for you to work in the denomination anymore. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. What happened was six months prior to this, some incident had occurred, and I was in her office, and she said to me, I could give you a letter right now that would allow you to work anywhere in the country. Take that letter. Go get a job somewhere else. So essentially she was saying, this is your last chance for me to get a public letter of approval. In my former denomination, which it now is, you could not move between districts or areas, or in the Catholic Church diocese, whatever you want to call it, if you didn't have a good letter of approval by the bishop or the administrator or however you want to name that person.
Right.
And so, in essence, she was telling me this is your last chance. Six months later, when this incident occurred, I was no longer going to get that letter.
Right.
So that meant I was trapped, or in my, we call it hang up your name. So it meant that I could not get a job because an administrator's letter is imperative.
Right. Well, it's a way to blacklist people.
And actually, so then the second process happens, which is actual blacklisting. So I then started reaching out to other denominations in the Protestant faith that we had relationships with that, in essence, have said over the years, your minister pastor can work in our church, and our minister pastor can work in your church. And I would call them, and I wouldn't get a call back. And I would call them, and I wouldn't get a call back. And then finally I got one particular secretary of one denomination, and she said, I want to tell you, you're never going to get a call. We're never going to call you back. And she said, because your administrator called my administrator and gave them your name.
Lillian, this is so identical. When I got trashed by the United Church, I went to the Unitarians, and they had received a call from the National Office of the United Church to watch out for this Kevin Annett guy. And sure enough, the liberal-minded Unitarians wouldn't have anything to do with me, although I'd been taking my kids to the church there for over a year, and they loved me, and they wanted me to do my work and everything. Suddenly, bang, persona non grata.
Yeah, my best friend in the ministry served in that other denomination. And actually, at one point, I had met one of their head, in that particular denomination, they had bishops. I had met one of their very head bishops and communicated with him, had very positive experiences, which also was the case in my denomination. I knew many of the administrators, many. And so they were the ones I initially contacted. And they repeatedly told me, so this happened within my denomination. They repeatedly told me we don't have an opening, when clearly they did. And then I got an unsolicited call from an administrator in a district that I hadn't even been reaching out to, which demonstrates to me that they are definitely talking to each other.
Yep.
And he said to me, your administrator is reaching out for extra authority. She is climbing the ranks. I don't like this. I'm being honest with you. I would take you into my locale so that you could serve as a minister in my locale just so that I could continue to build against her. So basically I was told I could be a pawn.
Right.
And that in that way I could serve. And I'm not going to do that.
Okay.
I've never been that person. So what I ended up having to do is I left my denomination for a very small denomination, but it's interesting because my new denomination is made up of all ex-ministers from denominations across the United States.
Right. There are
we
a lot
formed
of them.
Our own alliance. So.
You know, they figure that about a third of all the clergy in Canada, whether it's Catholic or Protestant or whoever, are forced out of their churches illegally and are damaged in a big way. There was a group called Ministry of Mutual Aid that helped me for a while.
I would love that study if you could email it to me, because that's the kind of stuff I find really interesting.
And the Alban Institute in America, they published reports about clergy have one of the highest levels of divorce and burnout and everything of any profession, including police.
It's interesting. Alban has done some great work in terms of determining just how destructive this job, this calling, can be.
Right.
And from the top, from the authority. And I actually had I had met with an Alban psychologist who worked on their staff, and it was just a brief meeting. And she said to me, I cannot in good conscience tell you to continue in your service as a minister, because it goes against the best, what's best for you.
Well, here's the thing. I do want to spend the last 20 minutes or so reflecting on this, because this climate of fear and intimidation of clergy, this is what helps cause the crime and the abuse to carry on, because everyone is too scared. The honest clergy are too scared to come forward, and so the criminals and the bullies and everybody win all the time.
I would say I completely agree with you, and I would say the key word in my former denomination is paranoia. Paranoia, of course, being a type of fear.
Mm-hmm.
But that as a system, that the entire system is paranoid, and that bleeds out into every single person in that system. So I had a minister that served in my area, and he had come over from the Catholic Church. And so he had thought, I'm finally going to be participating in a denomination where I can freely serve. And then he didn't reach out to me when I was fired. But then later he reached out to me when he decided to quit. And he said, I feel so guilty that I didn't reach out to you and help you, because I've been there before. And I don't know his story. I just know that he left the Catholic Church. But he said, I've been there before, and I should have helped you. And so it basically what it does is it makes ministers be in levels of either complicity, you know, or be complicit to collusion. It's
right.
A spectrum. And here we are. Good people come into these jobs, oftentimes good people who have bad boundaries, because the church identifies us from the beginning as being people that they can manipulate. And so I had another minister say to me, you know, when the church is psychologically analyzing people to see who's going to be a good minister, they're not approving the people that are strong-minded and tough.
No.
They're approving the people that they think they can abuse the most. And
I think
that
that's why I failed my first round of ordination interviews. I just
and I barely passed mine. I barely passed mine. It's a famous story that I wish I could tell you, but it would identify me, of how I actually got passed. But and so I can completely understand why you would fail. But the thing is that so they're seeking for people that they can manipulate. And then they have public materials that they present that say, we want wholeness and health and mind and body and spirit for our ministers.
Rhetoric.
But then privately, behind the scenes, they're telling you, I don't care what the federal laws are about working. You're required to work on this job 60 to 80 hours a week. So that alone is an abuse, because you are so stretched out, you're so tired, that they're paying you sub-minimum wages. You can't make it. You're not there for your family, either physically or emotionally, or with the needs that you need to provide for them, etc. So you're stretched out in all these ways. So you have this institution of paranoid people.
Yeah.
And what ended up happening for
me... It's amazing, too. I don't know what your experience in seminary was, but they didn't warn us about any of this stuff. It was criminal. They didn't tell you that you would face this situation. And then they set people up to be destroyed. It's remarkably similar to how they weeded out kids in residential schools, right?
Yeah. And, well, it shows that they have a playbook. A playbook. And one of the things that happened within that playbook is that even though all the legal authorities said I could have my file, because working in the church is one of the few institutions where you have a permanent file from day one.
Did they Myers-Briggs
all
you?
The legal authorities said I could have my permanent file, but the church never gave it up. And
well,
all
that's the thing. You see, the church historically is a law unto itself. It doesn't have to follow the law of the laws of the land. They can
and yet
discipline their own
the
clergy,
laws in my Oh, I'm sorry. The laws in my state and the laws of the state where the church administration was centered both clearly stated that church employees were not exempt. But here's the interesting thing. I reached out to ACLU. I reached out to all those classic organizations to support workers in need, and nobody would touch it.
Exactly. I went to all the civil liberties groups, the unions. Yep. They all hands-off policy.
Absolutely.
Yep. Now, there was something you mentioned earlier I was intrigued about when we talked the other day, and the mandatory reporting of child abuse. You said in the particular state you're in, they didn't require the Catholic Church to do it, or what was that all about?
Yeah, so I actually studied mandatory reporting in seminary as one of my classes, and it wasn't required. For everyone, there was a certain subcategory called ethics, and under ethics, there was a class called professional ethics and mandatory reporting, which is to show you how complicated the laws are in the United States. And so in the United States, the federal government has determined that mandatory reporting is handled under the purview of the state authority. And so one of the reasons why I wish all seminarians were required to take this course is it means that whatever you learn may be the case in one state, it can be completely the opposite in another state. And then thirdly, there is the idea that it is different both for Catholics versus Protestants, and that in some states, Catholics and Protestants are treated the same, and that in some states, and which is more often than not, the Catholic Church is exempt from mandatory reporting when the Protestant Church
is
not.
Amazing. Did they ever explain why they're exempt?
Yeah, they did. It was really interesting because it conflicted with the actual theological practice. So it proved that there was something else going on. They said the reason is because in the Catholic Church they have a physical place that you go to give confession. And therefore, because
of course,
the priest and the person who's confessing of the crime would be in a physical box or office, that therefore we could trust that they had truly built, you know, that was it. That was just it. They didn't even say therefore. They just said they had a physical location.
That doesn't make sense.
But in my church, we had a practice for confession and forgiveness that required me going into a physical location and shutting a door. So,
but
how is that different, Kevin?
No, but the thing is here, the Catholic confessional is supposed to be, and historically under the law, has been considered sacrosanct. So how is it helping a child if you're put in a situation when they're not allowed to talk about it?
Then secondly, the primary way you find out about abuse is not through confession.
No.
Very rarely is somebody coming to the priest and saying, I'm abusing people. It's more often than not the abused person, be they a child or a woman or somebody who's a vulnerable person, is coming to their priest or pastor and saying, I'm being abused.
And then under Catholic law, crimen solicitandis, they're then ordered to be quiet about it or they'll be excommunicated. If the priest talks about it...
Yeah, that's interesting because in my case, that's where mandatory reporting comes in and I have to determine if the state requires me as a Protestant in that state to be a mandatory reporter, but my former denomination stated that in their materials they said sometimes it's appropriate and sometimes it is not appropriate to report.
It's not appropriate to protect a child sometimes.
Yeah.
Okay, well, here's the thing, and I want to put this in a bigger context, because what they're not mentioning by all that, and they don't teach this in seminary, the Catholic Church is exempt from child protection laws in any country they're in, because of their own law, Crimen Solicitanus, it says it's a crime under church law not to rape a child. That's just a sin, which can be forgiven. The crime is to talk about it, and you can go into the Vatican prison if you talk about it, and that's happened.
Wow.
So
I don't doubt that.
Well, the U.S. government is helping the Catholic Church perpetrate a criminal conspiracy to protect child rapists. And that's what's reflected when they say they're not governed by mandatory reporting laws. Of course they're not.
Well, and then they give this ridiculous, nonsensical answer because they have a confessional box. That's what they told me. I knew it wasn't
government policy.
Real at the time that was the answer. I do want to say the last thing, though, is about this paranoia. Even when you're in that situation and you think you know what's going on and you're aware of the paranoia and you're fighting the good fight, you're still in that corrupt system, and it still invades you in ways that you don't know. So as the 3 years have passed since I've quit that job and also been blessedly found a home in a new denomination, two things have happened from that. One, I will never truly trust authoritative structures again. I love the denomination I serve in. I think it's great. I love being able to serve in the church as a pastor, but I will never fully support that denomination as not being something that could be corrupted. Number two, I've realized that in the time since, I have been deprogramming exactly as if I was somebody who had been in a cult.
Mm-hmm.
That ultimately the church is cultic in how it controls its ministers.
That's not really something that's named like that.
No, because we don't want to say it. Why would we want to say it? We're okay saying their cults over there, and it's Jim Jones drinking grape juice, but we would never... I'm a smart person. I'm a person who's in communication with God and prayer. I would never get duped.
Right.
And yet,
God doesn't
truly,
like a snitch.
I see that.
Well, particularly
in the people who I left behind. So,
Hello, are you there?
Yeah, I am.
Okay. The culture of silence in the church, paranoia, but also silence, It creates all of these crimes that we're talking about. It's people say, how could they have gotten away with genocide, and how come child rape keeps increasing all the time in the church? Well, you're pointing to why. Here's one of the major reasons.
Yeah.
It's a law to itself.
Also,
yeah, unmonitored.
Church I've ever served, except now, and that's just because I haven't been there long enough, did not have at some point in its history an abuse of a child by a clergy person. And
people always ask me this question. What has this done to your faith? Do you want to...
That gets back to the idea of the denomination or the power structure or authority. You know, Christ said to Peter, you are my rock, and upon this rock my church will be built. And so from there, I always felt that I could trust churches as being places of authority that I would be serving in God's command, in Christ's command. The world has proved to be stronger than that, and so they have corrupted those churches. So my faith now is solely built on my understanding of God, my understanding of the gospel of Jesus Christ, and the Word of God is printed in the Bible.
And not on the institution.
Yeah, it's not on the institution. I can't afford to put my faith in the institution that way. I have to have one eye open all the time. And, of course, that impacts how I can serve. It still makes it hard,
Yeah.
I'm a pastor's pastor. It's something that pastors complement each other with. But it also means that I'm in it for the long haul, and I can't quit, because being a reverend and a minister who serves and protects people and helps to lift them up and give them a voice and helps them to have their own voice. And that's so ingrained in who I am. And, you know, the church was right, when they almost didn't approve me for ordination and they thought maybe I wasn't the right person. Well,
you weren't a company woman.
Yeah, I wasn't a company woman. And
well,
I don't do
here's the thing.
I
wanted to ask you
it.
Because we've only got about 4 minutes left, and I do want
sure.
to have you come back at some point because we've raised all sorts of interesting things here. I know listeners are going to want to know more, but and I want to know more. But,
yeah.
You know, when Jesus said, "Where two or three are gathered, there I am."
Yeah.
And they never talk about in the Bible about bishops or popes or hierarchy or
yeah.
anything. The only system, like in the letters of Paul, they talk about presbyters and elders. You know, they talk about a congregation, in other words. They're not talking about an institution
yeah.
with investments in Monsanto and, like, the arms industry. And
yeah,
you know, like,
yeah.
So, for you, is this, like, that's
what
where
do?
I came out of this, realizing that if you have a faith, it's got to be expressed directly and locally, and it's got to be in the hands of the people. Any hierarchy
well, exactly.
surround that.
And that's the truth, right? It's just like in civil authority. It's just like in the government. Think global, act local. It's the same
yeah.
in the church. And so I learned from my husband to be what's called congregationalist and to serve
right.
in that, in the community.
Right on.
And so, and I would argue that, in essence, Scripture does, it doesn't say Monsanto, right? But, Ephesians, that's one of the letters of Paul. That's one of his most formal letters. He says in Ephesians chapter 6, he says, "Struggle not against flesh and blood, but against rulers, authorities,
right.
the cosmic powers of present darkness, and forces of evil." So
exactly.
who are those
now
cosmic
that, you
powers
of present darkness? You know what? That could lead into another
darkness.
Good discussion in the next show, the spiritual warfare. And I would actually
yes.
like to have you back on so we can talk about spiritual warfare, because we're deeply immersed in it with all of this stuff.
And I would love to, because that's a topic that the liberal Protestant churches don't touch with a 10-foot pole. They think it's, and that gets back to the divisions that are
okay.
false divisions. Like my,
well, I'll
my
invite you next week.
Pastor.
We've got a minute left, and I won't even ask you to sign off, because I'd like it if you're free next week or make it another time in April. But
next
please
week,
come back
April,
on. We'll do that.
Easter, so I'm going to be kind of busy.
Oh, Easter, right. Well, after later in April, we'll have you back. We'll talk about spiritual warfare. Lillian, I want
to
thank you for your faith, your brave courage, and for helping.
Yeah, well, thank you. You know, as these things were going on, I literally just Googled, except I didn't use Google. I used the other platforms
yeah.
that don't save your search history. And I came across your work. I mean, because I was throwing every search term in there. Because
yeah.
I knew if it was happening to me, it had to be happening somewhere else.
Oh, yeah. We'll
and
talk about
so
more of that.
So that's why I found you.
Lillian. We'll get into all this more later in the month.
Thank
I want to thank you for
thank
being
you
on.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
It's an honor.
Okay. Talk to you again soon. Thank you. And we'll be back next week. We're about to go off the air, but I want to thank you all for tuning in. ITCCS.org, republicofkanata@gmail.com. Send us your comments. We will be back here next week. Very special show. Please tune in. Until then, stay strong, stay clear. Thank you, brothers, sisters.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see.